There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to Excuse the Mess, the second episode of the second series. My name's Ben Corrigan, and I'm the host and creator of Excuse the Mess, and I'm delighted to be joined by Hannah Peel. She's appeared on the podcast once before, but she hasn't done the full-scale episode. And let me just explain to you, if you're unfamiliar with the format of this podcast, what that is. So I spend a day with a composer, talk to them all about their music, and then in the latter part of the day, we write a piece of music together. So they bring along an instrument, and we only have a few hours to make a piece of music using only that instrument without any pre-planning. As I said, Hannah has been on this podcast before. Between series 1 and 2, she came on as an extra mess episode where we just have a conversation, we don't make any music. But I asked her then, would she do a full episode? She said yes, and she wasn't lying, she's back. I would say that a lot of the topics we would have touched on in this episode have actually been covered in the previous episode, but you won't feel like there's any gaps. And if you want to know more about Hannah, the other episode is a good place to go. We spoke in that episode about her previous albums, not the most recent, but the two before that, Mary Cassio, Journey to Cassiopeia, and then Awake But Always Dreaming, which are two fascinating albums with really interesting backstories, and I recommend checking that music in that episode out once you're done here. If the name Hannah Peel is completely new to you though, here's a little synopsis lazily stolen directly from her website. Emmy-nominated and RTS-winning composer with a flow of solo albums and collaborative releases, Hannah joins the dots between science, nature and the creative arts through her explorative approach to electronic, classical and traditional music. Yes, as I say, if you want to know more, check out the previous episode. In this episode, we talk about her score for the official Game of Thrones documentary, which I'm sure is a topic lots of you can get behind. We also discuss her latest album, which is a collaborative album with poet Will Burns. That album is called Chalk Hill Blue, and the title track of that album is actually bubbling away underneath. Hannah's music, especially through the guise of Mary Cassio, has a certain cosmic quality to it, so we also talk at the very end about a special commission she got for the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. So yes, lots of chat enclosed, and before we get going, just a thank you to those that need to be thanked. Firstly, thanks to you for checking out this episode. I'm pretty confident that you're going to have a really enjoyable listen, hearing Hannah's music and hearing what she has to say about it all. A big thanks to Acast, who now host this podcast and have been incredibly supportive. And of course, thanks to Arts Council England, PRS Foundation and Isotope Audio for getting behind Excuse the Mess. Right, on with the podcast. This is episode 11 featuring the wonderful Hannah Peel.
Your episode last time was very popular.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it got a lot of love.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. Wow. And I've had a lot of friends say, how did I not know who Hannah Peel was? I love her music now. Yeah.
So how do we approach this one? Because we've obviously done one where we've talked about quite a lot of the behind the scenes, and we talked a lot about concepts of records. And
so, yeah, we don't necessarily need to talk about those things again. But since November, you've been very busy.
Oh, yeah.
So there's plenty of things to talk about. Yeah, a lot has happened. And in recent times, congratulations.
Thank you.
An Emmy nomination.
How bizarre is that?
It's not bizarre at all. Emmy nominated composer. Sat right here. Yeah.
Oh, insane. So insane.
You've joined the iconic Game of Thrones world.
Yeah.
Yeah. To score the documentary, The Last Watch.
The Last Watch, yeah.
Yeah. Well, how does it feel to get the nomination for your score?
Well, obviously, it's a massive honour, but also just, I just think keep thinking it's a fluke and someone's just going to like wake me up and go, no, you didn't. It's just a bit of a dream.
Yeah.
We were just messing with you. But I think, you know, when you always feel like you're, I always say like, I always do feel like an underdog because I've always done things against the grain. Like I've always, you know, Mary Cassio album, doing stuff with electronic and brass bands, and then doing an album about, you know, Alzheimer's and living with dementia. Yeah. And it's always stuff that is against the grain, which makes you become, or the people attach that word, innovative to you. But it's that you are an outsider. Like you are not, you know, I'm not on a label. Always been that kind of like person going, hey.
Yeah.
But I think my resistance to, and just keeping going and not stopping has been.
Yeah.
So for someone to then acknowledge you and as big as the Emmys is like, it's more than a dream come true because, you know, like at most I was like, God, I'd love a Mercury nomination one day. Yeah. You know, like that was the level I was, not like Emmy level. I'd never, ever even thought it would come close. But I guess obviously the Game of Thrones thing is a massive thing, and the documentary itself was really powerful and really beautiful. Mm. And so it was a real pleasure to be part of that and to write the music for it, because it wasn't just like a documentary. It was like scoring for a feature film in a way, because it was 2 hours long, and a lot of the, it wasn't like kind of like, oh, and here's the person sat here being interviewed.
Yes.
It was, you know, in the dirt and the mud and the rain of Northern Ireland in the middle of filming, watching the actors and the directors and everybody struggle with night shoots for months on end.
Yeah.
There was even like the prosthetics team, they're a couple that run that, and they have a little girl and they didn't see her for weeks or keep it in touch on FaceTime and things. So it was a really emotional film in a sense rather than a documentary. So anyway, that gave me a lot of scope to not just underscore dialogue, but then actually to be able to, you know, the scenes where the extras are running and screaming and going into battle and necks are being slit and, you know, gruesome things. You know, I was allowed to then kind of go for it with big drums and synthesizers and strings and be allowed to do that, have the freedom, which in a documentary usually you wouldn't.
No, a lot of documentary music is quite safe, but what you were doing was not
drama.
Safe. It was drama. It is, as you say, it's not a traditional documentary. It doesn't have those talking head tropes and that kind of thing.
No.
I found it a bit like an extended extras. You know, this
it's like it's an exactly extent, like that. And it's funny as well. My favourite bit is like the White Walkers are like sat trying to eat the lunch from the canteen.
Yeah.
And because they're covered in prosthetics, the food just drops on their lap and they can't get it in the mouth. And like people looking for severed heads. Where's the severed head?
Yeah, any severed head will do. Yeah. Just need a severed head. About those relationships with all the people behind the scenes and the actual stars. Like, I was thinking that they're like the extras. They barely get a look in.
Yeah, and Jeannie Finlay, the director's, her and the editor, Alice, they had 950 hours of footage break down to two.
Oh, my God.
So they spent months and months editing, sitting in a room together, plotting. And they had, like, their focus. I think Jeannie's plan was, you know, you've got the seven families of the world of Game of Thrones, so she wanted to find seven characters in behind the scenes that she could focus on.
Cool.
And talk through their journey, but finding those seven and focusing on which seven, because I think she had started off with maybe 15 to 20, and then you whittle it down.
Yeah.
Was, a big task.
I suppose you do need to have that parallel with the actual show, seven families. Seven characters, that's quite a nice way to limit yourself and focus in on the story.
Yeah, and she and my direction, she was really fantastic to work for, like really amazing. And, you know, the first thing that I, when I went to see the first very rough edits, went to the office in Nottingham where she's based above a cinema, you know, and saw like the things that you're not allowed to take a picture of or talk about or anything are so top secret.
Yeah.
But her, like, you know, direction was to me was I need loads of things that are to do with the weather. So, you know, rain, snow, ice, just everything you can think of, different weather varieties, and which was a really amazing way to approach composing because some of the things that I've worked on before and actually working on at the moment, I'm not given anything. I'm just told, write some tense music. And you're like, well, okay, that's fair enough, write some tense music. But if you're a visual person and you write visually, it's really hard to just come up, you know, obviously you can come up with stories in your head and stuff, but to have a director saying, this is the temperature that I need, and this is, it was really good and free as well.
Yeah.
So I loved it. So, you know, I went to town on quite a few tracks and just totally blasted, you know, gave her things that actually we've never used that I thought were great, but actually they just didn't fit the film. And mostly because they were synthesizer based. And actually what happened was a lot of the tracks that I sent initially, because they were electronic, they didn't have that handmade, raw feel and emotional feel that you need for telling a story like that. And actually it was the kind of more gentle piano and cello.
Sort of were able to tap into your folksy side, I think, for a lot of those cues. A lot like a lot of your earlier records and things, you were kind of using those sounds and feelings.
Instrumentation. Yeah, it was really weird because I had a real resistance to doing that because you don't really want to step backwards. You always want to keep moving forwards and on a trajectory that you are wanting to explore more as well. Mm. You're kind of stepping back. So actually it was quite a hard thing for me to do initially. Yeah. Like I had to then go, get rid of your ego, and get rid of that, and then go back. And obviously the music box is a big part of that because, you know, the music box is something that I used a lot and I use live, but I tend to not record it that much because it takes so long, A, to do, but then also on top of that, it's also a sound and a certain era of when I first started writing.
Yeah, definitely.
But that, I think, you know, that's the initial conversation that Jeannie had was, we've got this incredible tapestry, hand-woven tapestry of the whole of season 8. And they've done it for all the seasons. But you can go visit in Ulster Museum in Belfast.
Right, cool.
And she was like, it's going to work beautifully with the music box. And I was like, okay. So we managed to get the permission off the original composer and make it into a music box.
Fantastic, which opens the film. Thank you. It's interesting you're talking about reluctant to step back, though, into the sounds of your yesteryear, because there is, like, a definite trajectory and evolution of you as an artist. In fact, if you followed it, the Music Box is featured less and less. And then the folky instrumental side of things also gets kind of pulled back a bit, and the synths take over. There's a crossfade with synths.
Yeah.
And a deeper sort of darker
resonance
world.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's quite intentional from what you're saying.
Yeah, it worked like that.
Yeah.
It just seemed to manifest like that. I think Deanie was a lot more up for including it, whereas initially her kind of like was, no, this is not working, you know, you need to strip everything off this.
Okay.
And so actually a lot of the tracks I then kept, you know, the same melodies or chord sequence or feel, but then I replaced a synth with a flute, or I'd replaced so it still felt like I was retaining some of the work that I'd already done, but then stripping it right back.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, even actually, I don't know why I did this, but I've got an auto harp. I have a guitar in my studio looking at me. And I was like, I really need a guitar. And I'd forgotten that I had even a guitar in the room. So I was like, right, well, what's the closest? I'll get my auto harp. So I sampled every note on the auto harp, made a library out of the auto harp, and then put that through like all the guitar effects pedals in Logic, in Sound Toys, and then made myself a guitar. And then after I'd done it all, I went, oh shit, I've got a guitar. I suppose it does create that kind of otherworldly sound that doesn't sound like a guitar, it doesn't sound like an auto harp, so it does have that sort of element of Hannah in there.
And is every piece, I know there's like a couple of sync tracks, I think there's like a Leonard Cohen track and something else, but other than those, everything is yours.
Yeah, there's even a song that I wrote as well in there.
Ah, okay.
And sang.
I say that because the scenes, which are like action scenes that you'd scored, part of me thought like, oh, this is using some footage from the show, so maybe they've used the music from the show. It just synced so well, that's what I mean.
Oh,
so you scored like those things where it jumps between behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, it's just so seamless. And it must have been fun to be able to be so diverse.
Do you know what? I loved it. Yeah, it was fantastic. I've never had that much freedom on something in terms of when you're working with someone. And I mean, like, in a strange sort of freedom, because Jeannie was, you know, obviously very direct in what she wanted and needed.
Yeah.
But also, you know, as soon as I sent something, she's like, yeah, perfect. Done. You know what I mean? There was no kind of like making me feel bad or me being upset about, oh God, that's I can't write that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, like the normal insecurities that you have when you're composing and somebody asks something of you that you feel like, gee, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
It really felt like every moment of it was fun. And so I suppose even the fact that it's been nominated for an Emmy, maybe that's what's come across. Maybe that kind of freedom and fun and, you know, really playing to the picture in that sense.
Thank you. It sounds like it was quite a successful collaboration. You might not be able to say anything about the future.
I don't know. I think she's having a break, but if she does, I'd love to work with her.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. All right. If you're listening,
Jeannie. She might be so in demand now, she might not want to. But, no, yeah, I'd love to. So we're both going to LA to go to the awards together. And because it's the only thing that's been nominated, there's only... Yeah,
right, okay.
So it's just Jeannie and I.
Oh, well, great. That's nice. Yeah. It's nice that you've picked her.
Yeah.
I guess that's the right thing to do.
Definitely. And we'll have a good time because she loves getting dressed up like I do. And we love getting
makeup done. So she loves getting wasted. Yeah.
So we'll have a great time getting our makeup and hair and everything dolled up. And
great.
Yeah. It'll be good.
I mean, best of luck to you.
I guess by the time this goes out, we'll know.
This will be in October. So yeah, best of luck. And I'll do a little voiceover to say which way it went. But yeah, fingers crossed.
Well, the Emmys happened and it wasn't Hannah's day, but to get the nomination itself is just an incredible achievement. So congratulations on that, Hannah. I'm sure there'll be plenty more lofty nominations coming your way in the not-so-distant future. For now, let's listen to The Quarry, a cue from Hannah's Emmy-nominated score. It's time to have an Acast ad break, which you may or may not hear. When we come back after the Acast jingle sounds, we're going to be dropping into the world of Chalk Hill Blue, Hannah's collaborative album with poet Will Burns, starting off by listening to a track called Ridgeway.
Ridgeway. It could be the dogs announce your visit. It could be her birds. However it happens, she knows and opens red wine, puts out a bowl. Outside in the fields, the second hay crop cut and turned, a fading day. Dirt that might have been yours to own, an inheritance held in seed.
Chalk Hill Blue. That's another thing you've been up to since we last spoke. Beautiful album.
Thank
Incredible.
You.
And very different. I've not listened to an album like that ever before. Not to say that it doesn't necessarily exist, but like in a full album form, I've not heard anything like that.
So, really?
Yeah. If I have missed obvious things, please do tell me. There may be others.
I haven't got a reference for it at all, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't start it like that. It's a really interesting process to make a record like that. I suppose the only thing that's... There's been a couple of suggestions that it might sound like something, but the closest for me, and even that is not very close because it's improvised, but Patti Smith did, I think it's called The Coral.
So close. It's called The Coral Sea.
Which was a live performance of her reading with music. And I guess in some ways the feel of that is slightly similar. And it was the only thing I really had a reference point to. But we didn't know we were going to make a record, so...
Yeah. So tell me about where you first met Will and how that dynamic and collaboration developed.
Yeah. So, okay, Will, he's an amazing poet.
Yes.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And what I love about Will the most is he is so sensitive and can write these beautiful... Basically, he's like a musician in that sense. He's a... You know, poetry is music. You can create a world within his art form, and it's stunning. And yet he is like also like a lad, Like, you know, loves footy, loves cricket, loves drinking, and, you know, always up for a laugh and, yeah, a kind of a good rant about stuff. And yeah, then he writes this delicate poetry that's like, where did that come from?
Sure, yeah.
So he's really good fun to hang out with as well and to do an album with. And his, like, previous experience of music as well is his father set up all the Rough Trade shops. So he's grown up since he was born in Rough Trade. He knows about music. His only ever employer has basically been his dad.
Right.
Because he grew up working in the shops. And even now, his dad sold on his part of the shop and owns a pub, and now Will works in the pub.
Really? So, oh, that's so nice.
But his knowledge of music is wonderful. So he has a really innate musical sense about him as well. I think he, like, had a rap band at some point.
Obviously, you can tell. He's got that vibe.
But anyway, hip-hop, yeah. Hip-hop aside, he does not come across like that anymore. But he had written a beautiful poem called Out of Doors, which is actually now the first track on the record. And in 2016, when we did the launch of Awake But Always Dreaming album, as part of that launch, it was in association with Alzheimer's Research UK, who I really adore because of their work with the scientists and trying to find and fund cures. So, you know, that they support a lot of people. So the night was in support of them, even though we were launching an album. And it was at St. Leonard's Church in Shoreditch.
Yeah.
And part of that night was we had some film screenings and things, but then also we had Christopher Eccleston come and read poetry because of his father. Mm. And his father had lived with dementia as well. So we kind of all collated some poems and he chose some. And one of them was Out of Doors, right, by Will Benz. Okay. And it was just a beautiful, it was one of the most kind of poignant poems for me. And Will was local, you know, to East London where I was living at the time. And so we met up and said, let's at some point get together or think about something. Anyway, 2 years later, we eventually yeah, managed to meet up. Because, you know, when you don't know somebody, actually, it's quite hard to initially.
Yeah.
So Erland Cooper was in the studio and I said, look, can we invite Will over? Can you record and we'll just see what comes out? I'll play and write.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it, the three of us, in terms of Will would come over. And on the first session, he brought this huge pad of poetry.
Right.
So massives of, like, poems in back catalogue. And, you know, that nervous energy that you have when you first meet somebody and how do you collaborate,
yeah,
was kind of quelled because of Erland in the middle kind of saying, that one's great, this is great, or whatever, yeah, you know, and enabling that to happen as, yeah, in kind of the master wizard.
Sure.
In the session to, that, you know, get rid of any nerves or any anxiety or, you know, it's quite nervous sitting in a room and reading someone your poetry because actually it's really sensitive as well.
Of course,
well,
yeah.
So,
and you hadn't even gone for like a preemptive coffee or tea or something.
No.
So straight in the studio. Straight, yeah, in. Of course, that'd be. Yeah.
We did it like 3 hours. We'll see what comes out of the end of 3 hours.
Mm.
And then that's it. You know, we're not doing any more. We'll just see about this, okay, one track or, yeah, two tracks or whatever. So it started and I just played something on like I think I used a Jupiter 4 synthesizer and it's got an amazing portamento on the, yeah, Jupiter and arpeggiator as well. And I just played something and he was like, Will then was like, oh, I've got something that will suit this tone.
Out of doors. We knew sun up as mosquito time. Playing itself out in a damp wood and the madness, really, of a dawn chorus being taped. Our field recordings made so we might never lose a thing. Later, emptying his house, I found the tape machine, hit the play button and watched the acetate spool through the rollers, the ribbon taut against the tape heads, the capstan still running. Still keeping perfect time. It's a weekly hour I spend now, noting the changing greens of his nursing home garden. He cannot grasp what it is I've played him, how the report of birdsong swells into the spaces left between us, sitting here in this, his last and lighted room.
And then that just kicked it off, and it was either the music that kind of inspired his choice of the poetry, the rhythm, mm-hmm. he spoke it at as well, whether that went over what I'm playing or yeah. not. And then also if he was reading something, then I would also react to what he was reading.
Right.
So it was a really quick collaboration. And in that 3 hours, we'd done three pieces.
Had you? That's amazing.
Yeah.
So he had a selection of pre-written poems, but you were basically coming up with everything on the spot.
Yeah.
Which were the three in the first session? Do you remember?
Oh, my God. Well, Out of Doors, for sure. I think Afterwards mm-hmm. and Summer Blues, because before he'd arrived, I'd just sat and just written this riff on the piano. And I was like, well, whatever happens, at least I've got something to fall back
sure.
on.
Yeah.
But actually, when I started to play the chords, which were very much kind of like an Eric Satie type structure in yeah. that sense, he was like, I've got this poem, Summer Blues, that'll fit over it beautifully. And it did.
Summer blues, the blue wall and the house holding here like a burr in the shade of Shiver Hill. The begging and begging for you to build again, this time something cool and that will last and high up in the trees. But you aren't the man exactly you appeared to be that first night on Prospect Street. So the hard mornings after, mornings of frying eggs in a skillet, spitting oil against the wall, blue as a chalk hill blue, a crust of ladybirds inked dead in the kitchen window, and guitar strings that might rust to blue or ring forever. And my nights like a praying drunk, smashed and alone and falling asleep, watching YouTube clips of catfish rising and taking pigeons, teal, a dog even, off the water's broken surface. This kind of deep dark is all I will ever earn.
Sounds like you were completely on the same wavelength.
Yeah.
And how many more sessions did you have after that?
We did three more, so we did 12 hours, 9 hours together, and then I booked a woodwind player for a three-hour yeah, session.
Who is fantastic. Guy Passy?
Yeah. Right.
Amazing.
He's amazing.
I love the parts that you'd written. Layering of everything is just really fantastic and beautifully played.
Even that in itself wasn't scored. Like, I didn't give him the part.
Oh, okay, so...
I'd gone through it and mapped it. Like, you know, like how you maybe draw chunks, you know, in my mind. I'd gone, right, up 2 minutes, I want this kind of, for example, the nightlife. You've got this woodwind that goes bum, 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 bum. And I just said, I want that, and I kind of want it on that note. And then we just did it in the room,
wow.
rather than me going, here is a part, and this is what you'll play.
Wow. Unusual.
Yeah, the whole thing was really unusual.
But I guess you need a really responsive player to be able to do that. Yeah,
yeah, and like... I've worked with him before and know he's not so restrictive.
Yeah.
Like he'll happily improvise around what yeah. you give him.
Yeah, some players might be a little bit like snooty about that sort of thing. Why aren't you printing off a piece of paper for me?
Yeah, right, yeah. yeah I know. I've experienced those players.
Yeah.
yeah, definitely avoid that kind of musician.
Yes.
But I think... one of the things that I've really enjoyed about the Chalk Hill Blue, and actually more so when we took it live, because obviously recording is one thing, and like when you make any record, you do a recording and you're in that room, but then when you take it live, it's got a different essence altogether.
Yeah.
So when we took it live, that was when it started to feel like what we created was something that was different, if that makes sense. Like mini film scores to
yeah.
Will's poetry.
Yeah. I don't know if you have continued this throughout your touring, but when I saw it at Cecil Sharp House, you had this insane surround sound rig.
Oh, yeah. To do that kind of setup is a dream come true, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that was only our second gig, so it was still quite like nerve-wracking in order, like, how do we do this? But I met the guys that run D&B at WOMAD Festival. They run a stage there and they have it in surround sound at, on the stage in the tent. And they were like, do you have any projects that you'd want to work on with us? The first thing that came to mind was obviously Chalk Hill Blue. But actually the plan was to do it in the round. So we would be in the centre. A little bit like, if you can imagine, I wanted for us to not have this world where here's the poetry and here's the music.
Yeah.
And because it was so magnetic, I suppose, in the studio, and I wanted to make it feel like you were that kind of person in the studio with us, making that with us at the same time. You know, that feeling of like we're all in this together, more immersive. So from the word go, when I spoke to Will about, you know, the idea of like, how do we present this? I'd said, I think we should do it, you know, if we can, we'll do it in the round. And also we'll set this stage, we'll have a table, we'll have two stools, I'll be on one side, you'll be on the other, we'll be interacting with each other. So there was always that element of wanting to be immersive. So when D&B said we can do this, I was like, oh my god, like,
was it like 40 speakers?
Yeah,
you had
40.
It's insane.
You can fly the woodwind round the room, and the initial plan was to have Will's voice coming out of the center speakers so that you felt like you were kind of next to him. But yeah, we've definitely grown since that first performance.
Oh, right, yeah. You've gigged it quite a lot, actually, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had more confidence as the shows have gone on to improvise as well, so I've been more able to enjoy each piece fully.
Yeah.
You know, like, my improvisations are longer, they're more fluent, and they're a bit more dramatic, rather than I was so safe in the first one, because you don't know the extent to which you can push it. Mm. And also then you're aware that Will's sat on stage as well. So, but now I'm like, I don't care, I'm just like, we're in this world, and he's, you know, he can just pretend he's writing or doing something.
Sure.
And actually when we were rehearsing, it was really funny, because I wanted him to do more of the acting side.
Yeah.
And he was like, poets don't act. So, and I was like, yeah, but they do, you know, like, think of John Cooper Clarke, he's like, he's a performance poet. But Will was like, no, I'm not that. So actually we have these like moments where we are quite choreographed, because we know that at that point we're going to look at each other, at this point we're going to stand up together, at this point we're both going to sit down. And somebody called Will the other day when we did a festival, pop-up Will. He just, like, pops up on certain cues. and he likes to have a drink on stage as well, so he has an array of drinks.
Yeah, an array.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an array of beer references in the poetry as well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's got to be part of it. I think, you know, living, working in a pub at the moment, but then also growing up in a pub probably as well.
So. The very last bit is February. And the very last line is something like, the map on my phone tells me that I am 15 minutes away from a drink, and that's all the news I can handle. Is he all right?
Oh, yeah, he's totally fine. But I think it's that projection of breaking down of a person and how they deal with it on a day-to-day basis, but also the breakdown of society and nature. And the Chalk Hill Blue itself is a butterfly. Used to be quite common on the chalk hills of Buckinghamshire and is now rare, like very rarely would you see one. And so there's an essence of those poems not only referencing man himself and the day-to-day dealing of that in a urban and residential society where there isn't much scope for you to go much further. There isn't much in terms of employment. You know, the high street is dying. He sees those people come into the pub every day, buy drinks, you know, and that is their kind of life force, you know, like that's the thing they look forward to. End of job, go to the pub.
February. I could forget it all on evenings like this. The names, addresses, even our relations. Everything could be taken by the lights of the town in this weather. The process has something to do with the buildings, their vernacular of flint and brick, but there is also the matter of the people. How many there are? Do we know? Can we trust the data? The dogs at the borders, lapping it up, must surely just have their own reasons. And there are dogs, wherever a line is drawn. The map on my phone tells me, not just location, but that I am quarter of an hour from a drink, and that is all the news I can handle.
The chalk hills themselves are beautiful. And I suppose a lot of the record as well, whilst talking about the kind of more human consumption and our materialistic values, the chalk hills are entrenched with history and the way that, you know, the paths have been worn down by feet.
Mm.
You know, those kind of like tunnels that you get that are just basically carved out by people walking for thousands of years across them, like, you know, like carrying food or animals or just going from one town to another.
Yeah.
And so there's a real sense of like the choice of electronic music fitted really well, because it gave you that kind of otherworldly view and that industrialization of something, mm-hmm. as well, the kind of breaking down of things. So it seemed to work really well. And actually on Will's behalf, he said that he didn't understand any of... I mean, we were basically very much separate in our art forms. Like, I didn't tamper with his poetry and he didn't tamper with the music. And one of the things he said to me was that had it been like that I played guitar or something, he probably would, because he's from that world.
Yeah.
You know, he loves country music. He's a massive country music fan. Yeah. And like, so for him to come and do an electronic music record was a real kind of like, I have no idea what's going on.
Sure.
You just do your thing.
Yeah.
Which was really refreshing. So I suppose that in itself is a new way of approaching writing for nature, and the use of woodwind is a really beautiful way to tie in that, you know, electronic and nature.
Before I tell you the name of the track, just take a moment to soak in the music and picture what scene or environment it's trying to paint. For me, all of this album conjures up a lot of vivid imagery. Nightlife, and hopefully whatever was in your head syncs up with that nicely. Let's do the same thing with the next track. Will's going to say the title of the track pretty quickly though, so you've only got a few moments of intro to paint your picture.
Spring dawn on Mad Mile. There is no weather yet to define the day in those terms. No brightness or structural shadow has revealed the line or flesh of anything. The wood, the river, the guest house. You could be dreaming of the curtain and the breeze across your back, of the outdoors, the heat, or the bird song that appears to be everywhere, reports upon a sense of the unfamiliar that this hour alone is burdened with, that spreads like leakage, that becomes a drone. Thank you.
we're nearing the end of the first part of Hannah's episode. Don't forget that there's a music making bit to check out too, where we use the famous music box as our one and only instrument. To top off this part, we're going to dip into the more cosmic side of Hannah's music.
The moon in all its splendour.
Aww.
50 years, moon landing celebrations.
Yeah. Electronic Sound got in touch and said that they were doing a special edition limited 7-inch vinyl just for the magazine, so it's not available online or anything like that. But they also gave me the original kind of recordings of the Apollo 11 mission. And so I just lifted out some of the like the lines that were really lovely that kind of referred to the moon, you know, in itself. But they're kind of like chat of how it felt to be up there. And one of the lines was, "There's the moon in all her splendour." And I just thought that was a beautiful title.
Yeah.
So I chose that and used a lot of the Mary Cassio samples of the brass and then resampled it again. So it created a really nice loop. So that loop is just there from one of the tiny section of Mary Cassio.
I see.
And just kept it very bleak and I suppose beautiful. There was one bleak element.
Yeah.
The because I once saw a play about Michael Collins, who was the third astronaut that didn't land on the moon, that kept it flying. So he went round the dark side of the moon and he was on his own. And at that time he was kind of like the furthest human away from any other human, the human race. In a world.
Wow.
In the universe.
By himself.
Yeah, by himself. Ooh. On this dark side of the moon. So waiting to go and pick up the others. And I just thought that was a really beautiful imagery. So I kind of was making the track.
Yeah, it sounds like Mary Cassio hat fully went back on.
Yeah.
And it was really nice to hear more of that because it's one of my favourite things is the Mary Cassio stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Actually, one like technical compositionally thing. Do you often like take a one of the brass band instruments and blend it in unison with one of your synths?
Yeah, I do that quite a lot, actually, because I kind of like to blend what you're hearing, so you're not either hearing a brass band or hearing a synthesizer, so you just feel like you're getting both at the same time.
Yeah.
It gives it that otherworldly feel as well. It doesn't
totally
mean that you're keeping it all separate. It's just one entity, one journey, one kind of planet, and one moon.
Why you're not scoring the biggest sci-fi films yet. I still understand because
it's a cult record, that's why. It's like one of those records that nobody's going to know and or love apart from a few for like another 20, 30 years.
No, it's just so fitting. It's ridiculous. Like, I don't know, Kubrick would have been into your stuff.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing?
Totally. He would have loved it.
I'd love to work. Oh my God.
Wouldn't that be the dream, right?
Yeah.
Seriously, though, I can't believe the offers aren't flying in because it's just so brilliantly like evocative. And, you know, I'd just come back from a holiday. You mentioned in our previous podcast that you were reading Carlo Rovelli's Seven Brief Lessons in Physics. So I took that on a holiday and I was listening to your music, listening to Journey's Cassiopeia with that. And
did it match?
So well. Like, it's fantastic just thinking about these giant concepts.
It's really good to write to a book. I find it's really gives you a bit of grounding because otherwise when you're writing music, you feel like you can drift off and not necessarily be in the right place sometimes or you know, or you start to question yourself. Whereas if you've already got a kind of basis of something, then you've got it to bounce back and forth on all the time.
That's really interesting, actually, because I know that a lot of writers will write to music. So it's interesting to flip that on its head and write music to a book. Were you using that as like a structural reference point of Rebelli's?
No. I think once I had the idea about Mary Cassio, my structural reference was just in my head a short story about her. So I suppose in a sense it is literature, but it was very much there she is. And then she leaves Earth. And in the first piece, there was like the sounds of more earthy sounds. But there were some like chime bells that I'd recorded in LA. That was the kind of feeling of like you're leaving planet.
Yeah.
And then you're off.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you travel through a nebula and then you see Andromeda and then you get to the planet of past souls in the end. But it was really nice to be able to have my own imagination of who she is and where she is as a structure.
Yeah.
I haven't done that before. So Carla Rovelli's just played a small part in it in that it gave me the kind of factual background. So it gave me the grounding that I needed to this is okay, I can do this.
Yeah.
There's the scientific knowledge behind it and away you go. So I've read his latest one about time, but it's so complicated. It's read by Cumberbatch, but it's all to do with how time doesn't exist. It's just something we've placed into our society about the way we view time. You know, like if you live high up a mountain, you're on a different time zone to what you are at the bottom of the mountain. Like your time moves faster or slower depending on where you are. So, you know, what is time then if you're in one part of the world that's moving faster?
There you go. Always finish on a bit of science and space chat. Thank you for downloading and listening to this episode. I was so pleased to get Hannah back onto the podcast to do a full day proper Excuse the Mess episode. Do make sure you check out the music making part of it, because I think we're both really happy with how that track came out. Always brilliant to talk to Hannah, so thanks Hannah. You're a bit of a legend, so thank you for coming back to the podcast and being your usual interesting self. If you want to keep track of Hannah news, you can visit her website, which is hannahpeel.com. She's quite big on Twitter nowadays, so follow her at hanpeel. If you want to follow Excuse the Mess things, there's the website, etmpodcast.com, on Twitter, etmpod, and Instagram, etmpodcast. Thanks again for checking this out. Do all the sharing and liking and tweeting and subscribing if you enjoyed what you heard and think other people might enjoy it too. Of course, thank you to Acast for hosting this podcast. And just before we go, I'd mentioned a few minutes back that I was listening to Hannah's music whilst on holiday at the same time as reading Carlo Rovelli's Seven Brief Lessons on Physics. So I had this idea for the outro of this episode, and it was to attempt to recreate as best I can that experience for you. So underneath you're hearing Sunrise Through the Dusty Nebula, which is from Hannah's Mary Cassio Journeys Cassiopeia album. And I'm going to layer on top an extract of his audiobook where he reads from Seven Brief Lessons on Physics. And I actually emailed him to ask for his blessing on these plans, and he replied and said, yeah. So thank you, Carlo. I wasn't expecting that.
The growth of our knowledge continues, and with improved instrument, it is soon learned that the solar system itself is only one amongst a vast number of others, and the sun is no more than a star like others, an infinitesimal speck in a vast cloud of 100 billion stars, the galaxy. The 1930, however, precise measurements by astronomers of the nebulae, small whitish clouds between the stars, showed that the galaxy itself is a speck of dust in a huge cloud of galaxies, which extends as far as the eye can see using even our most powerful telescopes. The world has now become a uniform and boundless expanse. Through the Hubble telescope, a dusting of vastly distant dot appears. Each black dot is a galaxy containing 100 billion suns similar to ours. In the past few years, it has been observed that the majority of these suns are orbited by planets. There are therefore, in the universe, thousands of billions of billions of billions of planets such as Earth. But this endless uniformity, in turn, is not what it seems. As I explained in the first lesson, space is not flat, but curved. We have to imagine the texture of the universe, with its splashes of galaxies being moved by waves similar to those of the sea, sometimes so agitated as to create the gaps which are black holes. And finally, we now know that this immense elastic cosmos, studded with galaxies and 15 billion years in the making, emerged from an extremely hot and dense small cloud. To represent this vision, we no longer need to draw pictures of the universe, but to draw its entire history. The universe began as a small ball and then exploded to its present cosmic dimensions. This is our current vision of the universe, on the grandest scale that we know. Is there anything else? Was there something before? Perhaps yes. I'll talk about it after a couple of lessons. Do other similar universes exist? Or different ones? We do not know.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.